That's right.
Volume up and get ready. Welcome to my podcast. Usual Friday.
Hey, what is up, guys, and welcome to another episode with Jennifer Gardner, who is an empowerment strategist, a trauma specialist, and a podcaster from the United States. Hey, Jennifer, thank you for ever so much for coming onto the show. How are you?
I'm good. How are you today, Wayne?
Absolutely great, thank you. So, obviously, we've had a little brief chat, and there's a lot about you, and our audience are going to be absolutely, you know, impressed with what content we're going to be giving them tonight. So, tell us a little bit about you.
Okay, a little bit about me. Well, I'll start with what I do. I think that's the most common entry into that question. I have a few things that I do in my work. First and foremost, I'm an empowerment strategist. And what that means, it's kind of a fancy way to say I'm a coach, but I don't use protocols. I have a lot of background in working with trauma and abuse, and working with very specifically developmental and intergenerational trauma. And those are big fancy words for things that cause us to have reactive patterns of behavior, like knee-jerk reactions, troubling trains of thought. You know, sometimes how your thoughts, you just can't get out of a certain train of thought and it just weighs you down and becomes really heavy. That can be a trauma pattern, because trauma patterns do show up in our thoughts. They show up in our reactive behaviors, like if somebody is really hypervigilant or startles easily. Even trauma that gets embedded in the nervous system that makes us clumsy and accident prone, you know, that can be trauma that came from childhood too. So some of the issues, like if somebody just has generalized issues, I work with that in my office. I also have a podcast where I bring guests on my show to talk about challenges that they've had to overcome in life and what they did to get past those challenges. Because it's inspiring. It's inspiring for us to hear how people have overcome what we are currently struggling with. So that's the whole purpose of my podcast, is to kind of help inspire people just to keep going, because some days it feels so dark that you just don't want to go any further. And you're like, oh my gosh, can't we just be done?
Well, it's like what we do on our show. It's all about inspiration and adding value to other people's lives.
Exactly.
The other thing that I wanted to, you know, stop you on, because there's a certain subject that you mentioned about a train of thoughts. Mm-hmm. Now, most people out there would get that. And I used to suffer with that, whereas I would get constant scenarios in my head where I'd constantly play them. And is that something that you're talking about? Something that is curable?
I don't want to say curable. And the reason I don't want to say curable is because if you think about our survival instinct, we need that hardwiring to catastrophize. So, and that's what we do. The first thought that comes to our head, and usually the thought that we latch onto as if it's the truth of the moment, is usually the worst case scenario, you know, for you and, or for me or whatever situation I'm in. So we latch onto the worst case scenario because if we can prepare ourselves in the fight or flight response for the worst case scenario, anything that's not quite as bad, we're going to be able to get through it. And we are hardwired to do that. So that goes back to, you know, the example that you hear all the time about the saber-toothed tiger. So that survival instinct, we need that, because if there is in fact a saber-toothed tiger, or in modern times, a life-threatening situation here in America, it could, you know, it could be a shooter, it could be a car accident, you know, who knows what it is. People end up in situations where in the moment, they momentarily fear for their life. And that could be happening in the middle of a fall. Like you could slip on the ice and on the way down, have that moment pass through your head. Oh my God, I might not survive this. But it only lasts a moment. And even that tiny little moment can get imprinted in the nervous system. And then over time, that train of thought can just go out of control if you don't do anything to catch it, to notice your thoughts, and to learn to manage it. Yeah. And so it's not about healing yourself or curing yourself from it. It's about learning, what is this trying to tell me in the moment? Is it really true? Is my life really in danger? Oh, I thought for a moment that it was. And that's okay, because who knows? I could have fallen on concrete. I could have hit my head. I could have hit anything on the way down. It very well could have been a life-threatening fall. Mm. And learning to work with your body and your mind to make it believe that you're not constantly under threat moving forward. And that's what happens, is there's that little piece and part of us that thinks that we're constantly under threat. So we perceive threat everywhere we look from then on.
Hmm. It's an interesting subject, actually, to be fair, because there is a, you know, mm-hmm. I'd say the whole population does suffer with this in some sense.
Oh, yeah, we're hardwired.
Yeah,
and it's,
exactly.
We really are. We're hardwired to do this. What we've not learned in Western culture is how do we work with these little imprints when they get imprinted in our mind and in our nervous system? How do we work with them and renegotiate that? Because that becomes part of our autopilot if we don't work with it.
So what happens if you don't work with it? I mean, can it get worse to the point that you would never be able to, you know, fix that problem?
Yes, it can. I hate to say never fix it. It makes it harder to become aware because people will tend to over-identify with aspects of their personality and deny other parts. That gets a little bit deeper into it. But what can happen with it is just look around at society. Look at how reactive people have become. Think about triggers and people getting offended. Not many people have awareness of enough whenever they get triggered or whenever they get offended by what somebody else says. Not many people have awareness enough to take responsibility for that. So they're pointing the fingers and they're looking at you and saying, Wayne, you just triggered me. And they turn it around and they make it your problem. Mm. It's not your problem. You could have 20 people in the same situation and one person out of the whole group might get triggered or offended. Well, why didn't the other 19 people get triggered or offended by whatever it was you just said or did? That's because we all have different perceptions. We all have different capacities. And it's your responsibility to deal with your triggers, not mine. It's not fair for me to have to tiptoe around and, you know, and I'm not saying this gives people a license to be rude or cruel. Hmm. It's all about personal responsibility. It's about, oh gosh, that person said something that just doesn't fit well with me. Maybe I should speak up and ask a question to get more information instead of pointing the finger and automatically accusing that person.
Yeah. You're an absolute gem for coming onto the show, because literally, you know, in the space of just a couple of minutes, I've got a lot of questions to ask you on this, on this specific topic, if that's all right with you.
Yeah.
So you know, there is a lot of people out there in abusive relationships, man or woman, you know, they share that same, you know, uniqueness of, you know, abusive. Mm-hmm. What I wanted to really get across is, how can you deal with a partner that is being really abusive to you, putting things in your head to the point that you're believing in that? How would that person come away from that and, you know, refresh themselves, you know, from the abusive and from the stuff that's been put into your head?
Yeah. And that's a tricky question. Mm. That's a really big question, actually.
Sorry.
You could talk, like, you know, for hours on just that topic alone. Mm. Because when it comes to the cycle of violence, you got to look at, first of all, you know, the person who is the victim and also the person who is the abuser. It's highly likely that both of those people lived through some sort of childhood trauma. Hmm. And I want to clarify here what I mean by trauma. Okay. I'm not talking about an event. People look at car accidents as, oh yeah, that's trauma. Or, you know, your house catches on fire, or, you know, combat, things like that. People look at events as trauma. And it's not, what I'm talking about when it comes to trauma is not the event itself. I'm talking about what happens inside of you as a result of what happens to you. So anything that happens to you that limits your future response to a similar situation is considered trauma in the definition that I'm working with. Mm. So it's highly likely that both of those people endured some sort of trauma in childhood, and they brought, and the behaviors in childhood actually saved them. So if you think about abusive behaviors, think about the little kid who's 2 or 3 or 4 years old, and little kids at that age don't know how to verbally express, like an adult, what they want or what they need from the people around them. And little kids act out their feelings all the time. They cry, they whine, they throw tantrums, they laugh, they giggle, they play. You know, kids just exhibit emotions all over the place. Mm. And if a kid's not getting what he or she needs in the moment, they're likely to cry. And if they don't get what they need, a lot of times that gets bigger and turns into a tantrum because they don't have the language to say what they need. Well, if they start to get what they need in the middle of the tantrum, then that behavior is going to go forward. And the more it works, the more the tantrum works to get the parents' attention and get what they need, the more likely they are to continue throwing tantrums throughout life. Well, we go into adulthood and our tantrums become abusive to those around us. On the other hand, if the tantrum doesn't work in childhood and the kid ends up modifying his or her behavior to become the perfect child, oh, if I do this and I do everything perfectly and I'm a people pleaser and I do everything that my parents expect and I don't question it, I'm not doing what I want, but I'm doing what my parents want, then that gets you what you want because you're not getting yelled at, but you're getting praise. That can create behaviors where you become the people pleaser, you become uber nice, and you become the perfectionist or the high achiever. And if we pull those into adulthood, that can throw us into the role of the victim. And when you get victims and tantrum throwers in relationships, that can create a cycle of violence because you grew up with that in childhood. That's what you're used to. And it's really hard to get out of that cycle and get out of that loop if that's the environment that you're used to living in.
That is true.
So it takes awareness. It really takes a level of awareness, and shaming people for staying in relationships like that is not the way to help them get out. It's helping them gather awareness, helping them gather some self-worth, because a lot of times both the abuser and the victim in the relationship have very low self-esteem and very low self-worth. So it's helping people realize that we all have value. And a lot of times when we are taking on what society deems to be successful, instead of looking at what we each individually find successful in life, that can create a whole spiral of giving away who we are in order to be accepted by the rest of the world, if that makes sense.
No, that's absolutely, it does make sense. What I was going to say as well is that, you know, supposing that the victim managed to get out of the relationship, but what happens to the victim when they've got them prints left in their head? How would they overcome that?
It takes work and it takes self-care. And I have been in that situation. I really have. And I didn't start to get better until I gave myself some space, because a lot of times victims, when they get out of a relationship, they very quickly jump into another one. And when I gave myself space and I stopped with the dating game and really just took some time. And when I say some time, I'm talking a couple years where I didn't date, I didn't go out, I didn't do anything other than work on myself. Now I'm not saying everybody lived through the same type of trauma I did, because I have some severe, early childhood trauma in my past. So if somebody doesn't have as severe a trauma, it might not take that long, but it really took some space so I could get in touch with myself and who I am and what I want out of life. Because I spent years when I was younger, when somebody would say, "What do you want? What do you want to do?" I don't know. Who are you? I don't know. You know, 15 years ago, Wayne, I don't know if I could have answered that question. Who are you?
No. Honestly, you're a star. I'm telling you, it's put a smile on my face anyway. You know, everything that you said is, you know, on point. And a lot of people out there are suffering that, you know, they're going to be listening, they're going to be hearing this, and they're going to feel empowered.
Yeah. And we do, we have a tendency to give up our own authenticity for the acceptance of the herd. And there's suffering that goes with that, because, you know, we all have this desire to be seen, and we all wear different hats and masks, and depending on who we're with and what role we're in.
Yeah.
So it's this balance. It's this balance on what's appropriate in the moment and what can you live with, and realizing that when it comes to setting boundaries, set the boundaries with yourself, not with other people. If you set the boundaries with yourself, it makes it a lot easier on what you're willing to let in your sphere of influence and what you can keep out of your sphere of influence. And when you stick to your own boundaries, that's how you teach other people how you want to be treated. And whenever you make your boundaries about other people's actions, then it's pretty much the same thing as not having boundaries.
Yeah.
Because you're trying to control other people and you can't do that.
That is absolutely true. So moving back to the podcasting, would you say that your line of your podcast work would be in line of what we've been talking about?
Yeah, a lot of it is. I end up talking a lot about trauma and abuse on my podcast. And I bring people on my show that are willing to talk about some of the tough subjects. Like we talk a lot about shame on my podcast, you know, like, and I'll ask people to tell their experience of shame and what they did or how they got beyond it and got past it. Because what we know about shame is it's incredibly insidious. It's one of the topics that people are least likely to speak about whenever they're experiencing shame. And shame grows when it's hidden and when it's in the dark. And the longer you keep it hidden and the less you talk about it, the more likely the shame is to control your life, because then we're trying to hide. We don't want people to see that about us. Oh my gosh, I can't let somebody see my complexion, so I've got to cover it up with makeup. So there's an element of shame there whenever it comes to vanity, or I can't let somebody see what I really look like, so I got to put all these undergarments on under my clothes to make myself look less bumpy and more smooth, or I've got to, you know, work out so I can have muscles. And, you know, there's an element of shame that's under that if you're doing it for the vanity of it. And that's just one example. I mean, I could go into hundreds. That's just the one that came to my mind.
No, that's fantastic.
Shame is super, super subtle, and it controls us in sneaky ways, really sneaky ways.
Wow. No, that is really good that you've opened up that platform for that specific topic as well. You know, because, you know, I'm not going to lie. I mean, my partner does, you know, she does feel a bit insecure. She does worry about what people say or what people think, all of that stuff. I mean, that is absolutely great. The thing that you do with the podcasting.
Yeah. I think we all have a little bit of worry about what other people are going to think.
Oh, of course.
Again, that's very primitive. Because when you go back to tribal times, if you were cast out, like if you displeased the chief of the tribe and you were cast out of the tribe and you were on your own, that was life threatening. So we all have this really deep, you know, controlled by our reptilian brain survival instinct to be accepted. And it's when that acceptance overtakes our own authenticity that we suffer. We've got to get the two to work together. How can you balance being out in the world, being autonomous, being authentic, being yourself, and still connecting with other people and being accepted by them? And the way to do that, the secret, is to learn to accept yourself.
Absolutely. And what I love about, you know, working, you know, doing the podcasting that I do, is that I speak to a lot of people that always have a background to why they do the things that they do today. Like, for instance, that, you know, you're doing a number of things to help other people because you've been through that. And that's what I love.
Yes, I am. And that's interesting, because I do want to help other people who have been through similar situations that I've been through. And I think I was telling you before we started recording, in my practice, I offer peer-to-peer support, because I experienced several times in psychotherapy offices over the course of my life, instances where my treatments weren't helping me because there was a power differential. And I came out of childhood having issues with authority. I have that type of trauma left me with issues with authority figures. So when you have somebody who's got, you know, like a PhD sitting across the desk from you, and they allegedly know more than you do about yourself, that shut down my progress. And it took me a long time to figure out that, wow, I was wasting my money. And it was because the therapist didn't know how to connect with me. I'm not even sure there was an awareness of power differentials in the treatment room at that point in time. And now that we have this awareness, and when I started working with somebody who didn't have the PhD or the doctoral degree, and it was more peer-to-peer support, I started to get better really quickly. And I'm like, wow, there's a whole segment of the population that's really hidden. And that's why I do what I do. And that's why I consciously chose not to go back to get my PhD.
Absolutely.
Now, will I change that in the future? I don't have plans to. because it is so important.
Yeah, absolutely. And, you know, as you just mentioned about the authority and stuff, it's like, I remember it was about a few weeks ago that I went to the doctors and I turned around and said to him, I think I'm depressed. Bear in mind, I've got, you know, an addiction with nicotine where I'm, you know, I'm having to have the patches and the gum and stuff. And I've been on them for at least 2 years now. Now, I know I need to quit, but I said to the doctor, I think I'm depressed. So he turned around and he said, sit down and let's do a chart, which is the anxiety and depression. And I filled that in and he said, you're depressed. So the immediate thing that he done, because I registered with new doctors, and he turned around and said to me, we ain't got your notes yet, but I'm going to give you these tablets. So I took the tablets home and I sat there and I said to myself, am I really depressed, or is it my self-worth that I'm not happy with? Am I not happy with the way I'm constantly going through life with the nicotine stuff? And I actually put the tablets down, didn't bother taking them. And I actually sat there and I understood that it's the nicotine that is having the issue. It's not the depression. It's not the anxiety.
Yeah. Well, good for you for coming to that realization. Mm. And Wayne, is it okay if I just make a suggestion?
Sure.
When it comes to addictions, you know, especially nicotine, whenever you tell yourself, I need to quit, then think about how that feels when somebody else looks at you and says, Wayne, you need to, and then fill in the blank. How does that feel when somebody says that to you?
No, I've never had that. I've not really had that said to me, but.
Oh, you've never had somebody say, Wayne, you need to do this, or Wayne, you need to change your attitude, or you need to go sit down and be quiet, or Wayne, you need to, you know, they're telling you, Wayne, you need to do something.
Yeah.
If you think about how that feels, it doesn't feel very good when somebody tells you you need to do something. So again, there's that tiny little element of shame that just sneaks in, and it's really sneaky and it's hidden. So my recommendation is change your language and change your approach.
Okay.
So instead of saying, I need to quit, say, I really want to get my health back in a different way. So I would like to consider quitting.
Yeah.
And instead of thinking about quitting all at once, or how am I going to do this, or do I need to use hypnosis, just turn it around. And next time you have a craving for a cigarette, say, okay, I'm going to delay this for 10 minutes. I'm going to wait for 10 minutes before I have that cigarette. And then do that for a week or two, and then work up, and then maybe say, gosh, you might find, and this happens a lot with people, you know, it's that delayed gratification. You're teaching your body to delay the gratification that you get. And the more space you can put between the craving and fulfilling that gratification, the more you're going to train yourself to put more and more space in between it. And eventually you're going to get it down to where, who knows, maybe you're down to like 3 or 4 cigarettes a day, which really isn't that bad. That's not going to be super harmful for your health.
It's like it's like rewiring your brain, you know, not to give it its demand.
Exactly. So it's not, and this is so common when people want to quit something, they're like, oh my gosh, I have to quit, or I have to do this all at once. And my sister smokes, and I've heard her say this before. She says, as soon as I tell myself I'm going to quit smoking, all I can think about is smoking a cigarette.
That is true. That is absolutely and hands
down
true.
Because that's how our brains are wired. There is a book by a doctor. Her name is Kelly McGonigal, and the book is called The Willpower Instinct. Hmm. And in her book, she talks about the irony of the thing that stresses us out the most is the thing that we turn to for comfort. So if you, for you, it's nicotine. For some people, it's eating. For some people, it's shopping. So if you're like one of those shoppers and you have credit card debt, the thing that makes you feel really good in life is probably retail therapy. So whenever you're stressed, you might stop at the store on the way home from work and put more, you know, buy stuff that makes you feel good in the moment. You're putting more stuff on your credit card. And then a few weeks later, when the credit card bill comes, then you're even more stressed because you're racking up more debt. So same thing with food. When you get stressed, you turn to food, even though you know that you need to back away a little bit or change your eating habits. So it's a little bit about, instead of saying, no, I have to stop this, and shaming yourself into it, is teaching yourself to delay that gratification a little bit and working up to it.
Wow. That's impressive. Wow. Well done. Thank you for sharing that as well. Wow.
Yeah, you're welcome. And if you have a chance to look at her book, again, the author is Kelly McGonigal, and it's called The Willpower Instinct.
Yeah, definitely will. Is that available on Amazon?
It is.
Oh, cool.
It's all available right. on Audible. That's where I have it, on my Audible library.
Yeah, I think I need to get into Audible.
Yeah.
Yeah.
And something else I'd like to tell you, I have ADD.
Okay.
ADD comes from early childhood issues as well. And on my Audible account, I have a tendency to kind of drift off and have to go back and re-listen to chapters because I'm like, dang, I don't know what I listened to. I'm also taking a class, and in one of my classes, I'm like, crap, I got to get through these videos before we meet, and I'm almost out of time. I started playing my videos on 1.5 or 2 speed, and my first thought was, I'm not going to be able to do this, but I'm going to try it. My brain went, wait a minute, what? And it started hyper-focusing and paying attention. And so if I speed up this speed of the videos or the Audible books, I'm getting more out of them.
Oh, wow. That's cool.
I know. I just stumbled upon that. And I'm like, oh, I kind of get this. It's like, you know, there are people out there like Joe Dispenza, for example, when he talks about working with the neuroplasticity of the brain and rewiring your brain. Because our behaviors are so habitual. They're really literally part of our tissue memory and our cellular memory. So our body just starts doing things and our mind's not even thinking of it.
No, that's true.
And he says, if you want to change that, he said, one of the first ways to train your brain to start to change these behaviors is brush your teeth with the opposite hand, wow. your non-dominant hand, or, you know, do little things throughout the day with your non-dominant hand, switch your fork and knife and learn new motor skills, because that teaches your brain to start creating new neural connections. And then that makes if you can do it with your motor skills, then it makes doing it with some of your thought processes even easier in the long run.
Wow. So it's the coaching.
Mm-hmm.
So tell us a little bit about the coaching, because I know, because we had a brief conversation, you do quite a lot of things under the line of coaching.
Mm-hmm. I do. I tend to work with people who have generalized anxiety, generalized depression, not diagnosable, not really on medications or having like major depressive episodes, but the people who go to work every day, they're high functioning, and we see it a lot on some of these high profile suicides that we've seen in the last several years. I know here in the States, some of the names that stand out are like Robin Williams and Anthony Bourdain, Kate Spade, you know, even some of our rock stars like Chris Cornell, who was the lead singer of Soundgarden, Chester Bennington from Linkin Park. You know, you hear some of these big names that have committed suicide, and they all had this, they looked great from the outside looking in. You know, on paper, their lives were perfect. Mm. And so many of us aspired to have that life. And if you look around, how many of your friends do you admire that might have this, I think people generically refer to it as smiling depression. Mm. So that's kind of the type of stuff that I can work with before it gets to the point where somebody's ready to do something about it. Because with the smiling depression, there are a lot of, in all of their lives, there were apparently little cues and clues leading up to it that people just kind of overlooked because they continued to go out and smile and just have fun. So notice those spaces in between the smiling and having fun when you're around your friends.
Yeah.
But that's what I essentially work with, is before it gets so bad that somebody's willing to do something about it, it can be turned around.
Wow, that's impressive. So I know that you're an emerging writer as well.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. I have... A few years ago, I contributed a chapter to a book called Superwoman Myths.
Yeah.
And that was the first time I'd really been published, other than one or two little magazine articles. And in the last year or so, I've been writing blogs a little bit more often, and I've had several blogs posted on the Wellness Universe. I've had a couple accepted for a magazine, which is an online magazine called Women Magazine, WOMELLE. And so I've got some stuff out there, you know, a couple other places. I've got 2 books this year that I've contributed to that will be coming out later in the year. Those are not published yet.
Yeah.
So I'm starting to get some of my writing published. It's slow but sure.
Wow. You do a lot. You really do a lot.
Yeah. Well, I also, you know, I have an adult son and I'm not in a relationship, so I have a lot of free time that people who have families don't have.
That is true. That is absolutely true. So when you say merging writer, obviously that is writing chapters in books. So have you ever thought about like writing your own book?
I have, and I've got little bits and pieces of it where I have started writing my own book. And I'll be honest, for about the last 6 weeks, I've kind of been in one of these writer's block phases, and even stepping back and considering, wow, is this where I want to go? Do I want to take this in a different direction? So a little bit of recalibrating before I pick up the keyboard and you know, start moving forward again.
Well, that's definitely understandable. Well, you know, again, you know, we really appreciate you coming onto the show and sharing this real cool value, because this is going to help a lot of people out there as well. So is there anything that you really want to get across now to the audience?
The one thing I would really, really love for people to start doing is becoming self-aware. Because we are taught in society, and a lot of us are even taught by our parents, that it's more acceptable to, you know, just kind of complain about what's going on in the world rather than take personal responsibility to do something about it. And we can't, I get it, we can't go out and change the world. I can't change what decisions other people are making for themselves. The only thing I can change is myself. And if we all start to just kind of turn inward and look at ourselves and assess ourselves the way we assess other people, then we can start to heal.
Wow.
So start to look at yourself and start to have a little bit of self-awareness.
Absolutely. Thank you ever so much. We really appreciate this. And I'll catch up with you after the show.
Yeah, you're welcome. Thank you, Wayne.
You're welcome. Take care.
Uh-huh.
We are on air. It's Talk About Friday.